This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
My guest is A.M. Gitlitz. He's an independent journalist, cultural critic, and podcast host, and he's the author of I Want to Believe, Possidism, UFOs, and Apocalypse Communism, and a great new book, Metropolitans, New York Baseball, Class Struggle, and the People's Team. I love this book, and I think you will too, but after reading it, I have questions. So, A.M. Gitlitz, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
I love baseball, and I love the Mets. Game 6 of the 1986 World Series, one of the great sports thrills that I ever experienced.
And you were there?
On TV. Saw it on TV.
That was pretty good on TV.
Vince Scully.
I mean, I saw it on YouTube.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I saw it when it was happening. It was great. I know you weren't there yet, but it was fantastic.
I was in New York for Game 4 of the 2026 NBA Finals.
Oh, well, yeah. I saw it on TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a great, great final.
But probably the best game since the Game 6 of 86 for New York sports.
No, I think that's probably true. It was an, for a long period of the game, it wasn't that interesting, but then it got very interesting.
People don't want to talk about the fourth inning so much.
Yeah. Well, you know, that 1986 series, as you wrote about, had a lot of long games, extra inning games, you know, all through the playoffs. But what I was going to say is, although I'm a baseball fan, you know, I like the Mets, but I'm not like a Mets fan. And you think there's a difference between being a baseball fan and being a Mets fan?
I mean, there is for me, at least. I think that could be true for any fandom, right? But the point I was trying to make there is, what I was trying to look at in the book is the Mets are trying to tell us something larger than just a question of we're a corporation that fields an athletic team that's trying to win a championship, right?
Yeah.
There's actually something behind this team that has a lot to do with the history of New York, the way New York restructured in the post-war period, the political moment of the 60s when they sort of came of age towards their 69 miracle, and then the afterlife of that, which I'm a part of as someone who was born 9 months after the 86 World Series. And so
missed it by that much.
Well, in a way, I was conceived by it. So, so what I was trying to get at with that, that kind of provocation is that the Mets aren't properly, we can think of them not only as a sports team, but as artists, and baseball is their medium. And we don't necessarily have to like baseball to appreciate what they're trying to say, or perhaps maybe they're subverting the art in a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, I although my team affiliation is really the Giants, the San Francisco Giants, I went to a lot of A's games and shared a season ticket to the A's. And when they left, it was, you know, devastating. And going to an A's game was always kind of different than going to a Giants game, because the Giants had luxury boxes and sold out, you know, every time. And the A's had 5,000 fans there, unless it was a playoff game.
Well, the A's had their moments.
Yeah. And they lost a lot. But like,
having a good year this year, actually.
Well, now I'm mad because, you know, they left. So it's hard to follow them now.
That is sad.
But you make a compelling case about the Mets being this countercultural underdogs. So why do you think that this is true about the Mets? You know, as a more genuine community than the Yankees fans.
Oh, I wouldn't say it's more genuine. But in terms of the countercultural underdog thing, this is just first of all, it was part of their marketing in 62, their first year, because Branch Rickey, who was one of the founders of the team and pushed for the expansion of baseball that resulted in the Mets, really emphasized to their first owner, Joan Payson, former owner of the Giants, that the team was going to be really bad for its first few years. And they would need to progress towards a world championship by the end of the decade. And in the meantime, you would have to build and sustain a fan base on various kinds of novelties. So he had a very prophetic vision of how the team would be. And Joan Payson took this advice. And so, among other things, you know, she hired a lot of Giants and Dodgers old timers for the team, drafted a bunch of journeyman players. But it was clear this is going to be a really bad team. So they built this people's team narrative during their spring training leading up to their first exhibition game against the Yankees, where the Mets would be, in the long run, these redeemers for the bygone National League teams that would take down the elite Yankees. And they had this very kind of the moment aesthetic, this kind of pop art inspired, comic book inspired, blue and orange and cartoonish look to them. And the games themselves had, you know, it was very, it really represented the marketing of the time, the sort of Mad Men 60s. Like, they were on the vanguard of a lot of marketing stuff. And it attracted this young crowd. It attracted a lot of old Giants and Dodgers fans, but it also attracted the children of the baby boom who maybe thought baseball was boring when they were a bit younger, when the teams left in 57. But now they're in their mid-teens and they want to see what this team that's like marketed to them is like. And so they create what the Mets fans call the time the new breed of baseball fan, where they were loud and cheering and sloppy, and they had signs and they had this chant, "Let's go Mets," which starts as this sarcastic jeer, but then combines into a cheer. It was the first cheer like that in sports. They invented it. And so for a few years in 62, 63, and it really was a baseball subculture. It was a lot like the folk movement downtown, the beatnik movement. And then it ends up merging with the politicized New Left movement in the mid-60s. Most remarkably, not only a lot of Mets fans are involved in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, and I talk about some of them who actually are martyrs of that movement, but also the players themselves. You had Cleon Jones and Elio Chacon participating in a sit-in of a segregated restaurant in 64. The team votes to boycott games before the funeral of Dr. King in 68, which most teams did, but they were one of the only teams to do the same thing before the funeral of Kennedy later that season. And then in 69, a number of players on the team are vocally anti-war, including Tom Seaver, who dedicates their miracle World Series run to ending the war in Vietnam. So the concept of this book is that the Mets and the New Left were parallel and intersecting phenomena in the 60s. And then the rest of the book kind of looks at the history of baseball as a political medium and then what happens with the Mets afterwards.
Right. Yeah. So you've opened kind of the larger scope of your book. So it's not a baseball book in the sense that most every other baseball book is, and that and you say that right out. I'm not going to tell you about great plays, although you do. But
I was kind of full of it in that intro. But my point with that is that I read a lot of baseball books for this. I didn't have to do a lot of research into I didn't have to go to a lot of archives and stuff like that, because there's been hundreds of baseball books written. And when I did go to archives, everything I found was written about in these other books that I read. Becoming very familiar with the historical baseball genre, I noticed that the stuff that I like that I like to read these books were the stuff about the people and how the players felt and what was going on behind the scenes. And then when they're talking about what happens during the game and, oh, he made a great diving catch and then threw it in, it's like, who cares? You know, I can read. Like maybe a little bit of that is interesting, but that's not interesting to read on the page. The narrative is what's interesting. So that was my point with that. Is that I wanted this to be the story of the Mets as something larger than just, you know, what you can get on the scorecard.
Well, I think a lot of people enjoy baseball or music or movies as a diversion, you know, from political turmoil. I mean, with movies and music, because they have content, you know, politics is inextricable from them often. But baseball seems like, you know, the only thing you have to argue about is the umpire's call. You can go out there and sit. The guy next to you could have a completely different political point of view, and you could equally enjoy the game. But I, you know, argue about the new rules. That's another one. But you see baseball as a political thing all the way through its history.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, first of all, I think baseball is in a way more political than politics, if in the sense that we consider politics like who you're going to vote for. Worker, you know, when we watch a baseball game, we're watching workers at work, struggling through work, you know, just like a lot of us do, those of us who are workers. So that's already a lot more political than watching two members of the political class debate, in my opinion, at least. And so I think it's, you know, I would rather have a Mets flag outside of my apartment than like the American flag or a Trump flag or Kamala Harris poster or something like that. But then, yeah, the history of it is obviously deeply political. It's called America's pastime. So I want to understand what that means. Like what's American about it besides the fact that it was invented here. And, my first theory about this was that, oh, the American working class invented it. And then it was commodified by the capitalist or something. And I was totally wrong about that. In fact, it was invented by New York's middle class accountants and doctors and Bartleby the Scrivener and people like that in the 1830s, 1840s. They wanted to get some fresh air. They wanted to exercise. They wanted to socialize. They had some kind of utopian communitarian politics around that time as kind of well-to-do Republicans, proto-Republicans. And they invented a game that really matched their tastes, so both as patriots and as people who wanted to have an adult, an American game that had these perfect proportions, rational rules, everything is kind of well organized. And to me, they were building an allegory for the worldview of the middle class person, where there's this perfect balance between the technical rationality of capitalism, of reproducing the economy, which is what their job is. And then their desire as they're sitting at their, these are the first people with desk jobs, really. Their desire to get out of the office and go run around chaotically in a field or like, you know, go create a homestead somewhere. So you get this like very urban factory-like defensive infield and this more agrarian outfield. And a guy with a stick comes in and tries to mess the whole thing up and run around and causes like a moment of chaos. That's, I think, the game that they built, that they're trying to express their simultaneous fears and resentments and envy of the proletariat below them and the capitalist class above them. And they're stuck between it. That only becomes more obvious and more political or more politically obvious when the game professionalizes after the Civil War. And you actually get real working class people playing that game. So it's no longer even a metaphor of like, this is what class society looks like. And now it's actually a workplace that represents the total social workplace. And then you have these stadia, increasingly large stadia filling around them that itself is subdivided into classes. And so
because you've got luxury seats and you've got bleacher seats. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. You said it yourself before about the Giants and the Athletics.
Right. Yeah.
And so to me, everything about baseball is extremely politically obvious. And in many ways, you could say that it's metaphorical or hidden, but in many ways, it's not. It's right there on the face of it, and it's very literal.
Well, one of the things that I always loved about baseball, which they are changing a bit, is that when you go to a game in, you know, 1986 or in 2026 or in 1896, it's the same game. They haven't changed the game. There's no, you know, it's basically the same game. It feels, you know, timeless in that way.
I think that's true. Yeah, I think the major change in terms of pitching happens in the 1860s. And since then, it's played in different ways, different rules and stuff. But for sure, I agree with you there.
And that's one of the, I think that's one of the appeals. And the grass. I mean, the first time that I, you know, caught baseball fever, it had to do with how beautiful it looked out there.
Oh my God. I had a whole thing about grass that I had to cut out because that was just too
but that's
in the weeds, so to speak, about, you know, monoculture and the invention of the lawn and the romantic, you know, because, you know, grass is a plant, right? That yes. We've like propagated. It's not natural. You know, there's when the colonists came here, they didn't see these fields of grass. That was all planted based on these romantic ideas of, you know, European parkland or something.
Yeah, the park, it's a ballpark creating this. It's not, you know, I mean, it's a stadium, but it's a park, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the game was largely built at this this refuge for the middle class in Hoboken called the Elysian Fields.
Yeah.
And so this is, so yeah, we have these romantic ideas of baseball. It's, you know, if you fly over the suburbs, you'll see baseball fields, and it almost looks like a natural feature of the American landscape is these fields. But of course, that's not true. It's not natural. They're maintained and manicured, and there's all these politics behind building them or not building them, or, you know, maintaining them or not maintaining them, and where they get. And this goes into the demographics of who plays baseball, of course.
Yeah, well, who plays baseball?
Well, today it's largely middle-class Americans or upper-class Americans or Caribbeans, people from Venezuela, Dominican Republic, to a lesser extent Puerto Rico and Colombia. And this is because increasingly to be able to play it, you need to have professional training from a young age. And so the people who can afford that in the United States are people with privileged backgrounds. And the people who can afford that in the Caribbean are the people who are signed at young ages to these academies. So you're getting, and this has been the case since the 90s. In the book, I connect this to NAFTA, actually.
Hmm.
That you're getting clubhouses where half or more of the team is Latino and half of them are U.S. Americans who are usually white and usually from kind of a conservative background, you know, from Florida or Southern California or Arizona. And this is something, you know, I think the vast majority of fans just want to ignore this. But did you watch the World Baseball Classic this year?
I did not, but
okay, it was a really sad spectacle for, you know, I was watching, I didn't want to root against the United States.
Yeah.
But the United States team was almost entirely white, except for Aaron Judge and one other player.
Yeah.
Talking about 23 white people on this team. And they had this weird conservative militaristic attitude. The war against Iran had just started. They're all saluting each other. They had some guy who claims he killed Bin Laden giving them a pep talk. They refused to shake their opponent's hands.
Mm.
And then they're playing against Venezuela and the DR and PR and even like Italy and the Czech Republic. And all those players, fans are having the best time of their lives. You know, they're showing us how it's done. And the U.S. team is all a bunch of really boring conservative white guys. It's really sad. And what it made really obvious, I think for me, and I hope for other people too, is the decline of African Americans playing baseball. There's very, very few left. And that's a really depressing thing when you consider how important integration was to revolutionizing the game.
Yes. I mean, the integration of baseball in 1947 was, you know, that was before the integration of, I think it's before the armed forces. I think it's, I mean, it's very,
after that,
but yeah, around the same time.
But you know, Jackie Robinson was a big part of integrating the armed forces as well before he played baseball.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, why do you think there is a decline of, I mean, there's certainly no decline in African American basketball players or football players. Why baseball?
Well, it's what I was saying before, is that you need that professional training from an early age. And I think football is generally better subsidized in public schools in the United States. Basketball is a sport that is kind of just easier to play, and also became more of a black game in the 70s. And so young black people are more drawn in general to playing it than baseball, which, although it integrated, really suppressed the voices of its black players, all of its players. But I think basketball players were better able to express themselves in how they play and what they think in the 60s. And that made it a more attractive sport, besides just it being like kind of a more accessible game to play in urban settings. But you know, that's, even in basketball, you're seeing a similar trend where a lot of the players now are either not from the United States or are from increasingly middle class backgrounds. My friend Bradford William Davis, who's got a great blog called iBlack, a political sports blog largely focused on baseball, is doing some incredible research about the fact that such a high percentage of NBA stars today are actually from the middle class. So the same trend is happening there. But yeah, generally, and I make, this is another thing that I really want to talk a lot about in the book, but I had to reduce to like just a couple paragraphs.
Yeah.
Is that baseball's integration succeeded in one way, which was that black players led through their politics to a really strong and militant union in the late 60s.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't take the same kind of black militant stances as Muhammad Ali or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or the Olympic runners of 68. And so as a result, there was never this black nationalist or black autonomist tendency among baseball players. And so there was never the kind of challenging of the racial attitudes that continued from the front offices and from baseball management. And this became really obvious in the mid 80s when, not thinking of his name off the top of my head, but one of the front office, someone from the front office of the Dodgers who had been involved in integrating with Jack. Say again?
Al Campanis.
No, he's a white guy. It'll come to me, but, he was being interviewed on 60 Minutes or Larry King or something.
Al Campanis. He was on Nightline with Ted Koppel. Okay. And he was asked why they're not more black field managers, and he said, "Well, your black athlete is fleet of foot, but lacks the necessities to be a field manager." And Ted Koppel,
you're right. Yeah, this is what I'm thinking of.
And Ted Koppel,
and you know, he gets in trouble for this because he says it out loud. But it is just something that white baseball people thought that like black people are good at certain things, and they can't pitch. You know, they can't manage.
They came back from a commercial, and Ted Koppel said, do you want to clarify?
Exactly.
He goes, I'll clarify. What I'm saying is your black athlete, he's fleet of foot.
Yeah.
Just dug himself deeper in.
And so I think people, you could tell that was the attitude, I think, if you were a young black person. And so that the sport just kind of stayed white or like culturally white in that sense.
Yeah, we're chatting with A.M. Gitlitz, and he's the author of a new book. It's called Metropolitans, New York Baseball, Class Struggle, and the People's Team. You make it pretty clear in your book that you didn't like Vice President Harris as a candidate. And, I mean, as someone who writes from a radical Marxist framework, you know, how do you feel about, you know, you were praising Bernie Sanders, but... is there a difference between Senator Sanders and Vice President Harris or Senator Clinton? I mean, is there a limit to what electoral politics can achieve for the working class, regardless of who's on the ticket?
Well, you know, it's a great question. Certainly in terms of just what kind of policies they are pursuing or have pursued their entire lives, Bernie Sanders does talk about the working class. He does advocate for better things for the working class, a better social safety net, Medicare for all, for example. These are not abstract things to me and my friends. You know, a lot of my friends do not have health care. I might be getting cut off of health care this summer as a result of the actions of the governor of New York. So this is, you know, why I personally support someone like Sanders over someone like Harris. As a Marxist, you've got a good point. Yeah, these are, you know, this is both the right wing and the left wing are both wings of capital. This is all the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. But the point I was making when I talk about Harris in that chapter is not to say I hate Harris, she's terrible, she's the same as Trump or anything like that. I was actually making the point that the Mets and Harris have a lot in common. the 2024 Mets specifically, but I think that goes, that was sort of the realization that I came to as I was chronicling the Mets 2024 season, is that, yeah, the Mets are a uniquely progressive team historically. They're the product of the new left. There's a lot to be proud about in that history. They're better than the Yankees politically, right?
Yeah.
Or aesthetically. They're more fun. They're more joyful. They don't have these racist and hateful and transphobic fans in politics. They shy away from that stuff.
And that applies to Harris too, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But they're losers. They lost. Like they went pretty far in 2024. They made it to the NLCS and then they lost. And so that was my point, is that there's like only so far we can get. Like if we can be happy that the Mets are more progressive, we can pat ourselves on the back for being Mets fans, but don't we also want to win? And what would it mean to win in both these senses, right? So as a critique of Harris, first of all, just for being a loser.
Right, which she did lose. But in baseball, it is the team that loses because they don't play well. In politics, it's the politician that loses because people didn't vote for them. And there are external forces that make that happen, right?
I mean, I think she could have, if she had run a better campaign, she could have won. I think there's a, you know, unfortunately, the Democrats didn't do a very good autopsy. So we don't have the kind of insider information that they have. But I think if she had separated herself from Biden on a number of issues, including the genocide in Palestine, it would have gone a long way to keeping a lot of that summertime enthusiasm that friends of mine had. Even ironically, you know, there was like all this ironic, like, oh, we're going to pretend to like Harris because we have to stop Trump. And then as the campaign goes along, she becomes more and more conservative. She refuses to offer any, she refuses to even lie and say things that Democrats like. She starts campaigning with Liz Cheney. I mean, who is any of this for? It's like she was throwing the campaign, and I don't know that she was or wasn't, but the way the Democrats are acting right now, to me, they look like a controlled opposition party that does not mind being the minority party. And I think that's true of a lot of Mets fans too. It's like we're the little brother team, and that's fine with us. At least we're the more moral choice or something.
I think campaigning with Liz Cheney was kind of noble in that she was reaching out to Republicans who didn't want to vote for President Trump, because noble Republicans would see him as a challenge to democracy and the peril of democracy. So by including Liz Cheney, you're saying, you know, this is a place it's safe for you to come.
I don't think Liz Cheney is a noble person. I think her politics are purely evil. I think she's the daughter of one of the most evil politicians in American history, the most hated politician in American history. Maybe there's a handful of people that could have won over. But again, we're talking about running a good campaign here. We're not talking about running a noble campaign. It didn't work. So,
yes. Okay. What about the, in terms of Bernie Sanders, because I know you were saying Sanders, he was ahead of Trump in all the polls, and you thought that he was I guess you're thinking about 2016 as him being a better candidate than Senator Clinton. But the fact of Bernie Sanders being Jewish, I'm sure you're aware of how much anti-Semitism there is.
Sure.
In America today. Do you think a Jewish candidate, being a woman or being a Jew, those are two very difficult obstacles to overcome. I mean, the Trump ran for president three times. Yeah, being black.
Pretty big obstacle, too.
But that apparently was overcome. But President Trump ran for president three times, right? And the only time he lost was when he was running against a man. So to a large degree, whatever Harris had done as a candidate, she was still going to be a woman and therefore not going to win.
Well, let's say that's true. I hope that's not true, but we don't know. There's never been a woman president, so we don't know. Harris has never won any primary. She ran in 2020. She was one of the worst candidates of that field. She didn't run for the Democratic primary in 2024. She's never been popular. The people don't like her. People pretended to like her for a second. But I'm sure there's a lot of misogynistic reasons to not like her, for sure. There's also a lot of good reasons to not like her. She was Attorney General of California, right?
Yep.
Her record there is horrendous. She put a lot of people in prison for no reason. She's never really been particularly progressive. She has a lot of disdain for the left. So I don't know who she's for, right? She's never been very popular.
Yeah.
She seems totally in denial about this. She still wants to run.
Sure. Ralph Nader still wanted to run again, you know?
Yeah, but maybe he was in denial as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, Muhammad Ali was in denial too, right? I mean,
yeah, he wasn't perfect.
Yeah.
He was a real hero. He was a very brave man.
Sure. But he, after the thrill in Manila, when he took a beating like no one has ever taken, he probably should have not fought again, but he fought until, well, you know what happened to him. It's hard to back away from the
Muhammad Ali and Kamala Harris would make another great essay comparing the two.
They would make a good ticket. That'd be a good ticket. what do you think will happen politically in the upcoming next two cycles, election cycles?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the Democrats, it's again, I think just like all the other elections, it's theirs to lose. I think obviously the voter suppression is very scary and it's going to set them back quite a bit. But what I'm seeing right now is the Democrats are working really hard in a way that they didn't during Trump's first term to repress the energy of the base. The energy of the base, like in Trump's first term, is very strongly against Trump and wanting to roll back and fight and resist.
Yeah.
The candidates who are saying they want to do these things and have ideas and solutions and are more populist, more left wing, the Democratic Party is actively working against, to the point where I'm hearing, I think this is going to pass, but a lot of centrist Democrats arguing against the Democratic nominees. Like Graham Platner, we saw it against Zoran, the mainstream Democrats refusing to endorse the Democratic nominee. So even if you're a vote blue, no matter who person, you're looking at the Democratic base wanting these left-wing populist candidates, who, by the way, I'm also skeptical of these people. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not even a left-wing Democrat. I mean, I'm registered Democrat, so I guess I am kind of a Democrat.
Yeah.
But if like the most important thing here is beating Trump and rolling back what he's doing, we can't be punching left, right? That's my opinion. And I think if that keeps happening, then we're going to lose because centrist Democrats always lose. Like Biden won. I'll give he won.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think every Democrat that's ever been president was centrist.
Well, Obama was for sure, but he kind of ran. He was. So this is the thing: is like if Harris had run more like Obama, if she had kind of like lied to people and said she was the hope and change candidate, she would have had a better chance, I think.
Yeah. Do you think a politician must lie in order to win?
If you have terrible politics like Kamala Harris, you do. No one likes what she's about. What was her signature policy? Like a $15,000 tax credit if you start a nonprofit in an underprivileged neighborhood. Like, who's that for? You know, this was like a great thing conservatives were doing at the DNC is they'd interview people like, you support Kamala Harris, and be like, oh yeah, we love her. What policies do you like? And no one had any answer. Cause what is she about?
Well, wouldn't you say that she was about preserving democracy in the face of the fascist government that we're involved with now?
Okay. But how?
By not being a fascist, by not destroying the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, all the research that's been done in medicine that Trump has rolled back and
she run. This wasn't really what she was saying. I mean, she might have said a little of this, but this wasn't really her message.
That was the message I got, that she was going to preserve democracy and not allow this fascist government to take hold.
Well. Okay, I remember she was saying some of this at first. She was talking about Project 2025, and I was really glad she was.
Yeah.
Because that's what we're seeing now, with the whole playbook.
Exactly, yeah.
She stopped talking about it. She stopped talking about it in August.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's true. I mean, I think I heard...
There was this whole, the Republicans are weird thing, remember? Tim Walz.
Yeah.
Why are you so weird? Why are you so transphobic? Why do you want to stop women from voting and all this stuff? They decided to stop doing that stuff in August, and that's when the poll numbers started to shrink.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but you probably have done more research than I have.
I remember I watched it in horror because I wanted her to win.
Yes, I did too, of course, because things are terrible now. Now, you know, when I first got interested in baseball, I went to the bookstore, and there was a sports section. And I was sort of interested to see that there was a few books about golf and there was a few books about football and there was some books about boxing. And then there was 20 shelves of books about baseball. Baseball is a more intellectual sport. Why do you think there's some, you said you read a lot of baseball books. Well, there's a lot of baseball books. Why do you think it's a sport that people write about more?
Well, it's always, I think because of those middle class origins I was talking about, it does tend to attract a more literary demographic, I think, historically. I think that's changing a lot. There have been a lot more over the last few decades as football and basketball have become more popular, a lot more excellent literature on those sports. But, you know, why are there hundreds of books about the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 50s, right?
Yeah.
It's because we're talking about a large population of pretty educated people who were Dodgers fans. And so, yeah, why do you have so many leftist Mets fans? Again, this is New York City. Uh-huh. And so baseball was the sport in New York and other major urban centers where there's a concentration of the intelligentsia in a way that soccer is in Europe or Africa or, you know, around a lot of the world. People loved baseball. It was like their life in the United States in the first half of the 20th century, like soccer is other places. So I think it's a combination of those two things. First of all, sports writing and scorecard keeping being part of baseball since the beginning. Henry Chadwick was one of the popularizers of baseball, and he invented the notation system that you use to keep your scorecard. Yeah. And so that's already a very literary, mathematic way of engaging in the game, where everything can be you can see the game on scorecard with signs and symbols.
Right, the box score.
And then sports writing really developed through talking about baseball in New York in a way that was replicated for other sports.
So you're a New Yorker, and now you've written this book specifically about baseball, which is different than the books you've written before. And you're on a book tour. Are you traveling around the country? You're meeting a lot of people like me, podcasters, radio broadcasters, bookstore people interviewing you and that sort of thing. How's your book being received? Have you met with resistance? Just in general, what's it like?
It's way more positive than I expected. I honestly wrote some things in this book to make people mad, not people like you, to more conservative people. You know, I like turned up the woke meter in certain sections, hoping to make conservative Mets fans or, you know, conservative sports fans in general take me down in some way. And maybe that's coming at some point. I don't know.
Yeah.
But so far, the people who I expected to really like it, you know, kind of like DSA, lefty Mets fans, obviously they like it. But then I'm really shocked that a lot of apolitical Mets fans and even some conservative Mets fans, or more centrist Mets fans too, they'll say like, oh, you're a lot more to the left than I am, but I really appreciate what you're doing. I really like it. The most controversial thing, is I made this comment in one interview with Hellgate that, the point of watching the Mets isn't always to win. And like, maybe if the Mets were like the Dodgers, that would change the character of the team in a way that I wouldn't like. And, the Mets Reddit was very upset about this. Not everybody. Some people got it, but a lot of people were like, no, F that. I want the Mets to win the World Series every year. That's the point of being a fan. And that's the thing that people have gotten the most upset at me about. But it was a bit of a diversion to talk about, you know, Harris and Sanders and all that stuff. But I'm like relieved. I'm like, finally someone, cause, I did a couple of interviews with, another older baseball scholar who I really respect. And he sent me his questions beforehand, and there was going to be stuff like that in there.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, let's go, please. Let's do it. But he pulled it. He was trying to be too nice. This is a political book, so I'm happy to talk about that political stuff. And I almost feel like maybe I didn't make it sharp enough that we can have these kinds of discussions.
Well, sure. I mean, that was sort of my point earlier. When you're at a baseball game, you could be sitting next to a Trump MAGA Republican and enjoy the game as much as they do and share the moment of joy with them, because politics is one aspect of life, but not the only one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, at Mets games, you don't see the Trump people so much.
How do you know? Everyone's wearing a Met cap.
Well, I talk about this a little bit in the 2024 chapter that in Trump's first term, people who wore MAGA hats to games would kind of get bullied. One person had like a Trump flag and got assaulted.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then in 2024, you'd see it more often, and like no one cared anymore.
In San Francisco, if you have a Dodgers flag, you'd be assaulted.
Well, Mets fans aren't really violent like that. I mean, like Yankees fans or Phillies fans. If you're being really obnoxious, maybe it would progress into a fight. But my point is that like by 2024, people just rolled their eyes at it, or like maybe they'd heckle you like they would heckle a Yankees fan, like all in good fun.
Yeah.
Because like I said at the beginning, like at a certain point in 2024, it just felt like, okay, you're the worst of two evils. There's really no point fighting about that. You know, because I think in Trump's first term, and I talk about anti-fascism a bit in the book too, there's this idea that we have to fight all the Trump supporters, or at least like the most Nazi Trump supporters. And I think people came to this maturation process like, no, that's not going to work. You can't stop this by fighting people or it's a systematic thing that's producing these far right reactionary politics. So we have to think about it more systematically. And so I think like you're saying, accepting that we might be sharing space with conservative people who might want us dead, or, you know, I've got a lot of trans friends who can go to Mets games very openly and proudly, fortunately. The fact that we can share a space that they probably like accept them, is, you know, there's a bit of tolerance in this space, is a nice thing. I agree with you about that.
We're chatting with A.M. Gitlitz, and his book is called Metropolitans, New York Baseball, Class Struggle, and the People's Team. And it's a great book, and you should read it. And then you can write Andy and tell him what you think, and he'll write you back.
Yeah, right. Don't write a bad review. Just don't like on Amazon. You can write a bad review for like a paper or something.
Have you been getting,
argue with me some other way?
Have you been getting reviews on Amazon that have perturbed you?
Oh yeah, only a couple, but it's like there's a couple reviews that are like clearly from a right wing person who is just like, I didn't realize this book was going to be about communism. Like, well, it's in the title, so
that's right. It's right there.
Maybe don't give me a bad review because you didn't read the title before you bought it.
So there's something about politics and sports, and I've thought about this a lot. So it used to be, and I think the way that you and I were talking earlier, it's about you look at a candidate and you think about what they stand for and what they have to offer and how they either reach your points of view or don't, or represent you. And that's how you make your decision about who you're going to vote for or support. But now it's more like a belief, in the same way that you believe in your team, whether your team is the Oakland A's and they're not going to do anything, or the Mets, or in the way that you believe in religion. That is, if someone believes that Jesus Christ is their savior, then there's nothing you can say to them that will make them stop believing. And if someone doesn't believe that, then there's nothing you can say to them that will make them believe it. And so when you talk about people who are in the MAGA Republican place, they seem to have a belief that has nothing to do with that you can't talk them out of it or reason.
Yeah, some of them are in a cult for sure. Probably most of them. But I think we're all indoctrinated in some way. You know, it's very hard to, we need beliefs to make it through life.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to hold beliefs lightly enough that you can be constantly be reevaluating them and saying, oh, I was wrong. I try to do this. I feel like I might, maybe just as a result of being a very critical and neurotic person, I'm able to reevaluate my beliefs better than others. But yeah, for sure. Some people you just can't walk them through with evidence, you know, okay, this is what Trump said at the beginning of the war, or, you know, this is what Trump said about Iran a year ago. This is what he said when he started the war. Here's what he's saying now. You know, it doesn't matter, right? I agree with you, but his poll numbers are sinking, right? So there's some movement there. But your broader point, I completely agree with, is that we have these team loyalties, and these team loyalties are keeping us kind of stupid. Loyalty to a certain political party is collapsing dramatically for the Democrats and the Republicans, but faster for the Democrats. And so this is part of the crisis of democracy that we've been talking about. So part of what I'm doing in the book is reexamining what it means to be loyal to a team. And I have this theory that a theory that I've kind of developed since the book's coming out because of this positive reception that I mentioned.
Yeah.
It was like kind of a joking theory while I was writing the book that Mets fans are, you know, in their soul, they're communist or socialist or something. I don't really believe that. But like I was thinking like, well, that's a funny premise for like me writing the book. But how well the book was received by like such a wide spectrum of people, it made me think, OK, maybe lacking, you know, in another time, another place, there would be a big communist party or a big socialist party or the IWW or something like that. And millions of people would join that party and fight for that thing. But we don't have that in the United States. We have two parties that are very similar. And so as a result, people take those politics, you know, these ideas of a better world, and they put them into different kinds of fandoms that are coded for those politics in various ways. And I think the Mets are one fandom that have been coded as leftist and progressive. And so people kind of gravitate to it, no matter what they actually think politically or how they vote or whatever. And so I'm also, in the conclusion of the book, I'm also criticizing that. I'm criticizing this substitution of politics for sports teams and other kinds of fandoms. And I quote one of the ex-Mets who I've talked to, Daniel Herrera, who said, yeah, I mean, I started out playing baseball. I was an Astros fan. And then I think a Rangers fan, I think. And then the Rangers traded me, and then I stopped being a fan. I can never be a fan of any other team again. Cause I was, you know, as a worker, I realized that my fandom was ridiculous. And so, I think that that's the lesson that I'm trying to bring out in the conclusion to some extent, is that our fandoms are ridiculous, and sports fandoms are kind of nice because we can admit that at some level, we could always say like, oh, well, they lost. They blew it. They let us down. They sucked this year. I can continue living my life. I can move on to something else. I can watch another sport or start reading a different comic book series or something like that. And so what I argue is that if we want to get outside these fandoms and get back to like what politics really means, we can be loyal to the international working class. And that's what I believe as a Marxist. This is the team that we should be on, no matter if you are a worker or not. If you're loyal to the working class, it cuts through a lot of this BS. Easier said than done, but that's, you know, that's what I'm, that's kind of my closing message.
When your team falls out of contention, do you still follow the sport? Do you watch postseason after your team?
I'm watching the Mets right now.
Yeah. Yes. but what about you know, in the postseason, if your team is not in it, do you keep watching? Do you watch the World Series? Did you watch the World Series?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. Not, you know, I mean, the World Series last year was amazing, right. But how much of it did I sit down and watch it? Not really, you know.
Uh-huh. After that 18 inning game, World Series game last year, one of my friends commented on Facebook, yeah, that game was so long, it was like the first 20 minutes of any soccer match.
Well, soccer is, I don't get soccer either. I agree on that. And it makes it kind of hard because, you know, I'm right in New York right now. That's World Cup fever down here. They're showing the games out on the street and stuff, and it'd be a good thing for me to get into it, but
yeah.
It's not for me.
Well, what is your plan writing wise? What are you going to write next?
I'm supposed to write a book about anti-fascism.
Yeah.
That's due this summer, and I'm going to take a crack at that. It's always kind of changing, you know, because Trump he just announced some new prosecutions against people for allegedly being Antifa in Minneapolis. And he's got some convictions of people in Dallas as well around the Prairie Land case. And so I think you and I, despite our political disagreements, this is something that should be really concerning for both of us, for all of us, really, is that the labeling of Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization has nothing really to do with, you know, kids and ninja outfits, you know, trying to fight Nazis. It has to do with people who oppose the right and oppose, you know, his ruling, his oligarchy, essentially. And he's trying to make it so if you oppose them in any way besides speech, and also speech,
you're right,
to some extent too, you can be labeled and charged as a terrorist. So I'm going to try to write something about that.
And they'll be coming after you, I'm sure.
I mean, I think they're going to come after a lot of people before me. they started with pro-Palestine activists who were not U.S. citizens. That was what he did right after coming in. And again, the Democrats did not defend these people. So I'm worried about myself to some extent because I have these radical politics, right? But I know they're coming first for all the other people on the list before they come for me. And I think we all have to, rally around the people that they're coming after first.
Well, Andy, I hope that you'll come back and talk to me again about whatever book you write if you're still a free man. Coming.
I'd love to. Thanks for talking.
Oh, my guest has been A.M. Gitlitz, and his book is called Metropolitans, New York Baseball, Class Struggle, and the People's Team. It was nice to meet you. Thanks so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
You too. Have a great afternoon. Bye.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.